Welcome back to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the author of The New Arab Wars, Uprisings, and Anarchy in the Middle East. The author is Mark Lynch, and the publisher is Public Affairs. Mark Lynch, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to have read the book. Such an interesting topic, and I've really been looking forward to talking to you about this. Before we get started, why don't you tell us just a little bit about where you are now, but also where you were before, because I think both of those really do inform the subject matter that you're writing about. So tell us just a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, you know, so I teach political science, Middle East at GW, but I also direct something called the Project on Middle East Political Science, which is kind of a national and now international network of scholars focusing on the region. And in that capacity, I interact with an awful lot of academics, both here in the U.S. and over in the Middle East and in Europe. There's been a pretty large scale collective enterprise of trying to understand the Arab uprisings of 2011 and their aftermath. And so I think a lot of the work that I do is certainly, you know, it's my own take on this, but it's also informed by what I consider to be a genuinely very robust political science community collectively trying to deal with these really profound changes.
Now, you've written about the subject matter a lot, and including in the book length, and this current book follows an earlier 2012 book, if I'm getting the sort of the titles right, The Arab Uprisings.
That's right. So the Arab Uprising, you know, that was a book that came out right at the heat of the moment. So I was really writing that extremely quickly back in the fall of 2011. And, you know, that was a time when the passions were still very high, when, you know, it really seemed possible that you could have this enduring positive change in the region. And so I was trying to capture that sense of, you know, what's really unique about this moment, how it's not just politics as usual. But the book also, it ended on a cautionary note, and it pointed out that, you know, every previous episode of this kind of mass mobilization had ended up with more repressive regional regimes. And so I was really trying to, at that moment, try and capture this idea that we could go in a number of different directions. No victories had yet been won, but it was still a genuinely transformative moment. And then this book is written, and we've gone all the way down that path of the dark side, where basically everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And so a big part of this book is trying to explain why it went down that path and not the more positive one.
Right. And it seems to me that in this latest book, The New Arab Wars, you contend that the regional dimension of this period needs much greater attention. Let's, you know, even before we get to that thesis, if that's part of your thesis, correct me if I'm wrong. But before we get to that, how do you define this region? What are its boundaries? What are, in your mind, what are we really talking about here during this time period?
Well, so there's certainly a number of players from outside the Arab world that really matter. You know, so Turkey is very involved. Iran is very involved. Israel, the United States, Europe, you know, they're all involved. But I define the core of what I'm talking about as the Arab world. And the reason I do that is not just because of, you know, kind of scholarly decisions, but also because the uprisings themselves were really, truly an Arab phenomenon where the people involved, they understood it that way. There was this region-wide discourse about change and then a region-wide discourse about the violence that followed. And it's not just that it was conducted in the Arabic language, and it's not just that it was on shared media like Al Jazeera and satellite television, but there's a pretty profound identity dimension. I mean, basically, you might have something happening where you have protesters in the streets in Greece or London or even in Iran or Turkey, and people in the Arab world would watch that and they would be interested in it, but it was very clearly something about them. But if it's happening in Yemen or happening in Tunisia, it's us. And it doesn't matter where you were in the Arab world, you understood it that way. And that was actually a very interesting and I think very important part of it, that all of the stuff that unfolded was very clearly part of this single common region-wide narrative. And it was defined around what is really this new kind of pan-Arabism.
Now, much of what happens during this period can be traced in some ways back to Tunisia. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how what started as relatively small protests at the outer reaches of the region jump to Libya and Egypt and Syria and elsewhere. What is the mechanism at work that ties this together?
That's a great question because, you know, at the time, most political scientists who were following Tunisia, they looked at it and they thought and they argued at the time that what's happening in Tunisia was probably going to stay in Tunisia because they saw it, that those protests is rooted in the local conditions in Tunisia and they didn't see it as you know, replicable in these other environments. But what was interesting was that, you know, when it started happening in Tunisia and when it spread from the periphery of Tunisia to the capital city, it became the focus of regional media, both new social media and also Al Jazeera, the satellite television station based in Qatar. And they framed it very much in this collective way that I was describing a moment ago. So, you know, if you were an Egyptian, you were watching Tunisia and you were certainly interested in what happened there, but you were immediately drawing parallels to whether or not this could happen here. And it was quite interesting to watch that unfold in real time. There's a tremendous amount of popular attention to what was happening in Tunisia. And one of the things was that basically you saw protests happen around the region. That was nothing new. I mean, people have been protesting in Egypt and Morocco and places for many years, but nobody ever won. I mean, the very idea that a ruler could be overthrown like this was just seemed crazy. And when Ben Ali suddenly left and fled the country, it just absolutely shocked everybody. And they suddenly said, well, if it can happen there, why can't it happen here? And I think that was the diffusion mechanism. It was the identification with what was happening and then the application of that to local conditions.
Now, you refer to anarchy in your title. Is anarchy the political ideology of the protesters, or is anarchy the outcome of other forces and quite unpredictable forces? Get us to sort of how anarchy fits into this story that you tell.
Yeah, by anarchy, I didn't actually mean kind of either the international relations term, you know, from realist theory, or that these were anarchists. So I just meant more this trying to capture this sense of things spinning wildly out of control. That going against the idea that this was either some kind of centrally directed conspiracy or that it was under the control of anyone in particular. And you know, so as you mentioned a moment ago, a big part of the book's argument is about the regional dimension of the backlash against the uprisings. And I think it's very important that you saw these states in this highly competitive environment where they're all intervening, all interfering in other countries. And that's really trying to introduce the international relations aspect back into something which to this point has largely been studied in comparative politics terms.
Now the role of the U.S. in this is fraught with lots of internal conflicts, and you know, especially with respect to Syria. You've had the chance to get up close and personal with many of these policymakers. How would you characterize their interests and their strategies? Was there a consensus position? You offer some thoughts on this. Was Obama's Syria policy a failure?
Well, so there was no consensus on any of this. There were deep divisions going all the way back to the very beginning. I mean, Tunisia, everybody was pretty much on board. It's a good thing to have democratic change in Tunisia. The stakes are fairly low for Washington. But over Egypt, there was an extremely conflictual debate about what to do, because Hosni Mubarak was certainly an autocratic figure, a dictator, everything else. But he was also America's closest friend in the region, and there were deep investments in that regime. And so, you know, when the uprising spread very quickly after January 25th, you know, there's a huge debate about what the United States should do. And, you know, should we try and hold on to and preserve our close ally, or should we actually try and usher in some kind of democratic change? And there, I think that ultimately, as in almost every one of these cases, it was Obama himself and a small group of people around him who I think won out in that debate. And, you know, so they clearly saw what was happening in Egypt as part of this possible democratization. I mean, they saw the old Arab order as fundamentally unsustainable, and so they saw this mostly as a positive thing. If you're in the Defense Department at the State Department, you see Mubarak as one of your major instruments in the region, and you're very worried about what's going to happen. But at the end of the day, you know, in Egypt, I don't think it mattered all that much what Obama or Hillary Clinton or anybody else thought, because by the time the U.S. got around to formulating a policy, there were millions of people in the streets. And the idea that Obama could have said, OK, everybody go home, it's just ridiculous. And there's no way that the U.S. could have done much at that point to tamp things down or to save Mubarak. But I still think, though, that the simple fact that Obama was willing to embrace the uprising in Egypt and to not just accept, but actually to really endorse this idea of uprising and change, was really quite extraordinary. I don't know that other presidents would have made that decision. And it absolutely infuriated and terrified all the other leaders in the region, because they could all see themselves in Mubarak's shoes. And suddenly they're wondering, you know, what's Obama going to say when the protesters are in my capital city? And whether you're in Riyadh or in Doha or in Amman, you're suddenly saying, now, wait a minute here. And so that's, I think, actually the origin of a lot of this quite profound divide that we now see between Obama and many of the Arab leaders, is that they saw him, in their view, abandoning Mubarak. And that's something which they've just never quite forgiven.
Now, where do we stand now? You sort of have begun to allude to this a little bit. Is this still best understood as a regional conflict, or do the national context now matter more to peaceful resolution of ongoing wars, or is really hope for peace not part of the conversation right now?
You know, it you have to look at that in a couple of different ways. So, you know, at the level of there being a unified popular Arab consciousness now, that has largely faded. I mean, now you have a region which is really divided and polarized along a number of lines, with sectarian, religious, between, you know, all these different competing strands. And so what started off as this really quite extraordinary moment of unity has now given way to really fierce polarization. So in that sense, I would say that that moment is gone. But at another level, if you begin from the states or from the regimes and not from the public, there's more intervention and more interaction than there's ever been. You've got in a place like Syria, for example, you've got deep, intimate involvement with the insurgency by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Iran. They're in there supporting local factions. In Libya, you have the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, all supporting local factions. And then you can go down the list. In Yemen, there's a major Saudi-led military campaign with a number of coalition partners. And so there's definitely a region-wide battlefield now, which is very different from this notion of popular unity. But it's still, you know, I don't think you can explain anything that happens in the region in any individual country right now without at least taking into account the regional politics of it. It doesn't mean the regional politics explain everything. I mean, basically, these are intensifiers, accelerants, retardants. You know, you have different states supporting different networks. So I don't want to be read as saying that it's all regional and the local doesn't matter at all. But I don't think the local is sufficient to explain outcomes anymore.
And I actually wanted to just ask that question, maybe taking a step back. You are, I would say, more widely read than most political scientists. I think your audience stretches to more corners than your typical professor. And for that reason, I suspect that you're probably read and thought of outside. Have you gotten responses to this current book? Is there a reaction in any criticisms at all?
Sure.
Or endorsement. What kind of feedback do you get from those that are maybe involved in a way that might not be normally involved in a typical political science publication?
I would say that most people who are involved in the region and regional politics, I would say most people like parts of the book and intentionally dislike other parts of it, because, I mean, it is a fairly opinionated book, as you saw. I mean, not in a sense where I'm not trying to be opinionated, but I am trying to adjudicate hotly contested domains. And so on Syria, for example, I mean, my argument about Syria, that is essentially that the militarization of the insurgency was a disastrous decision, and that the external support for the insurgency has had profoundly negative consequences. And that cuts against, by far the dominant opinion among the leadership in many of the elites in the Arab world, for whom supporting the Syrian opposition and Syrian insurgency is a really high priority and something which they've really put a tremendous amount of both material and emotional investment. And so, you know, there's a lot of criticism of my argument against intervention in Syria and against the arming of the opposition. And I would expect that. And similarly, in a place like Egypt, where I place the blame for the failure of the Egyptian transition, not just on the Muslim Brotherhood, as is now popular, but on a much broader constellation of failures across the board, including from the liberal and secular parties. Again, you go country by country, you'll find people objecting to the narrative and argument. But to me, that's fine, because I think it's important to lay down a clear argument and then listen carefully to the serious objections. I mean, you mentioned the larger readership. But I've also been, it's not just that a lot of people read it, it's that I've just been heavily involved in social media and the online space for a long time. And what I've learned from doing this for over a decade is just that there's a tremendous number of really smart, engaged people who you can learn an enormous amount from. And you have to have a thick skin, and you have to be willing to accept, a lot of abuse as well. But if you're able to separate out like the kind of the ignorant or the political or just like the nasty stuff, separate that out and focus in on the people that have something constructive to say, you can get more like real time active feedback on what you do through Twitter, Facebook, short articles in the Washington Post, Monkey Cage. You get this feedback in real time, and it really, I think, helps to sharpen the arguments. So if people who read the book carefully and have been following me throughout, they'll see where my arguments change over time from when I wrote something maybe 2 years ago, because I got really good and thoughtful feedback and criticism. And a lot of it I listen to and I say, nope, I'm not convinced. I still think I'm right. But other times I listen to it and I say, that's a really good point, and I have to take that into account. And so it's just a new type of scholarly engagement. An article I published in Perspectives on Politics, the title of it was called Political Science in Real Time. And I think that's a really important part of what we do now as a profession, or it should be a big part of what we do.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point. And certainly the thick skin part is easier said than done. But great advice, nonetheless. I think that getting that kind of feedback that can happen almost instantaneously can be so helpful to
people involved
to pushing
a project. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I'll have written something about Iraq or about Bahrain or whatever, and I'll get emails from the people involved, and they'll say, "I read what you wrote. I think you're exactly right, but here's something you don't know." And yeah, these are things that you might not necessarily be able to quote, but it certainly helps to enrich and inform your opinions on these things.
Yeah, the book, again, is The New Arab Wars, Uprisings and Anarchy in the Middle East, published by Public Affairs this year. Mark Lynch is the author. Mark, thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.